Hello, and welcome to Notes in the Week Ahead, a JP Morgan Asset Management podcast that provides insights on the markets and the economy to help you stay informed in the week ahead.
Hello, this is David Kelly. I'm Chief Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. Today's March 18th, 2024. This week, investors will be focused on the Fed's second FOMC meeting of the year. They're widely expected to make no change in interest rates. However, Fed communications will provide guidance on two important subjects. First, they'll update their summary of economic projections and their dot plot forecast for the federal funds rate. Second, and particularly in Chairman Powell's press conference, they're likely going to provide some further hints on when and how they could begin to phase out quantitative tightening. While their messaging will likely continue to point towards monetary easing in the months ahead, the implied timing and extent of that easing could have a major impact on markets. Data since the last FOMC meeting at the end of January have been mixed, showing a continued very gradual cooling in economic growth in the labor market, but somewhat stronger than expected inflation. Since the end of January, the Atlanta Fed's GDP Now forecast for first quarter GDP growth has slipped from 3.0% to 2.3%, while our own forecasting now pegs first quarter growth at closer to 1.5%. The February retail sales report released last Thursday was particularly important in reducing those estimates, as a revised and measured retail activity in both December and January. Labor market data also suggests some further cooling. Both the January and February jobs reports showed stronger than expected payroll gains. However, the February report contained hefty downward revisions to gains for the prior 2 months. In addition, the unemployment rate has edged up from 3.7% to 3.9% between December and February, amid signs that recently higher immigration, although chaotic, is beginning to boost low-end labor supply. That being said, current wage growth of 4.3% year over year is the same as it was 5 months ago, and is still a little higher than the Fed would have likely regarded as being compatible with 2% consumption deflation inflation. Finally, based on last week's CPI data, we expect the year-over-year core consumption deflation inflation rate to come in at 2.8% in February, the same reading as in January, although well down from its peak of 5.6% in February 2022. As the FOMC reviews the economy this week, they should express some satisfaction with the overall picture. Despite aggressive monetary tightening over the past 2 years, the economy has avoided recession so far. Unemployment is low and steady, and inflation pressures still seem to be on a gradual easing path. However, little progress has been made on that path, either since the Fed's last meeting at the end of January or the prior one in mid-December, when they last provided explicit guidance on the path for interest rates in the form of their dot plot projections. And that is where the danger lies in this week's meeting. Among the 19 FOMC contributors to the December dot plot, the median forecast of the federal funds rate was 4.6% for the end of this year, and 3.6% for the end of 2025, compared to 5.3% today, or in other words, 3 25 basis point rate cuts this year and 4 next year. This is a logical approach for an economy with steady growth and inflation only slowly falling to the Fed's 2% objective. Monetary policy is restrictive, and it makes sense to bring it back to a more neutral stance. Moreover, this timetable would allow the Fed to cut only during those meetings when they produce a new summary of economic projections, that's March, June, September, and December, adding extra clarity to their actions and establishing a pattern that markets can get comfortable with. This pattern would allow the Fed to embark on its journey of policy normalization at its June meeting, well in advance of the November election, so they couldn't be accused of favoring one party or the other in a late-in-the-day policy switch. However, looking more closely at the December dot plot, it's clear that it wouldn't take much to upset this plan. In particular, at that time, 6 FOMC participants favored exactly 3 rate cuts this year, 8 favored fewer, and 5 wanted more. If just 2 of the 6 centrists were to turn slightly more hawkish, the forecast for 3 rate cuts in 2024 would shrink to 2, upsetting this timetable and markets at the same time. Clearly, investors will be watching the dot plot when it's released on Wednesday to see if the Fed is still on track to deliver a first cut in June. However, they will also listen carefully to Chairman Powell's words on the phase-out of quantitative tightening, otherwise known as QT. Since June 2022, the Fed has been gradually cutting the size of its balance sheet, and in September 2022, the pace of this reduction was increased to up to $60 billion in treasuries and $35 billion in mortgage-backed securities per month. This program has continued at this pace since then, despite the opening of a bank term funding program in response to the mini banking crisis in March of 2023. As a result, total Fed assets have fallen from a peak of almost $8.9 trillion in April 2022 to just over $7.5 trillion today. At first glance, it would seem like we should be very far from any decision to halt quantitative tightening. After all, total Fed assets at the end of February 2020, on the eve of the pandemic, were just $4.1 trillion. At the current pace of quantitative tightening, it would take at least another 3 years to reduce assets to that level. However, the Fed is likely on a much more accelerated timetable to taper and then end quantitative tightening. To see why this is the case, it's important to understand the mechanics of how they attempt to control short-term interest rates. Between 1982 and the Great Financial Crisis, the Fed implemented monetary policy in a fairly straightforward way. The Federal Open Market Committee would set a target for the federal funds rate, that's the overnight rate paid by banks to each other to borrow reserves, and instruct the trading desk of the New York Fed to buy or sell treasury bills or other short-term securities in order to add or drain liquidity from the system and thus achieve that target. At that time, the Fed paid no interest on reserves, so the commercial banks liked to keep their reserve balances as close as possible to the minimum legally required to back those deposits. This was sometimes called a scarce reserves regime. However, in October 2008, as the Great Financial Crisis began to unfold, the Fed started paying interest on reserves as a way to exercise greater control over short-term interest rates in general. Since then, they've also begun to offer overnight lending facilities to other institutions that don't qualify for interest on reserves, such as money market funds and government-sponsored enterprises. Currently, the Federal Reserve pays commercial banks 5.4% on reserves and offers 5.3% to non-bank institutions for overnight reverse repurchase agreements, known as reverse repos. Not coincidentally, the current federal funds rate at 5.33% is in the corridor between the offering rate on reverse repos and the interest rate in reserves. However, this focus on the corridor misses the essential point about the Fed's current operating procedure. At its essence, we are in an abundant reserves regime, where interest rates that the Fed pays banks and non-banks respectively provide a floor for the federal funds rate, and the sheer abundance of liquidity in the system prevents the federal funds rate rising much from that level. Ignoring for the moment the wrinkle caused by non-bank institutions, the abundant reserves regime could be imagined as a very large sumo wrestler pinning a rather puny opponent to the floor. In this picture, the sumo wrestler represents abundant reserves, while the floor is the interest on reserves. The floor prevents the opponent from going any lower, while the abundance of the sumo wrestler prevents him from rising. In the same way, the fact that banks can earn a safe 5.4% on reserves held at the Fed means that they won't lend reserves to other banks for any less than that. Thus, the Fed's interest rate in reserves, currently at 5.4%, serves as a floor for the federal funds rate. However, the huge volume of reserves held by the banking system over and above what is necessary to meet various capital liquidity programs requirements means that the federal funds rate is unlikely to raise much above this level either. The availability of Fed-sponsored overnight reverse repo facilities at a slightly lower rate for non-banks complicates this picture a little. The rate on these loans, currently at 5.3%, now serves as an effective floor on overnight rates in the market. If the overnight rate rises above 5.3%, non-bank institutions have an incentive to lend reserves. However, if the overnight rate rises above 5.4%, both the non-bank institutions and the banks themselves have an incentive to lend funds overnight, thus truly flooding the system. Perhaps it's best to think of this as our very large sumo wrestler as pinning an opponent to a mattress on a floor. The interest rate on reserves is the top of the mattress, the interest rate on overnight loans is the bottom of the mattress, and the puny opponent is stuck somewhere between the top and the bottom of the mattress. However, what happens when the Fed puts the sumo wrestler on a diet? That's to say, it begins to reduce the abundance of reserves in the system. The Fed did this in its last bout of quantitative tightening that began in October 2017 and ended rather abruptly in September 2019, despite the fact the total Fed assets at the time were still well above $3.5 trillion. Given the overlapping liquidity and capital requirements imposed on the banking system in the wake of the Great Financial Crisis, the strong desire of banks to hold substantial buffers above these levels and the impact of the Fed's willingness to hold currency and the Treasury Department's account balances at the Fed on reserve balances, it's just not clear how much the Fed can reduce reserves without triggering a spike in short-term interest rates. That limit was, however, apparently reached in the middle of September 2019 when the effective federal funds rate shot above the Fed's target range, which was, at the time, between 2 and 2.25%. In an immediate response to this episode, the Fed injected liquidity into the system to calm rates down and cut the interest rates on reserves and reverse repos relative to the federal funds rate target range to provide a buffer against this happening again. They also effectively ended their program of quantitative tightening. However, the episode highlighted the Fed really doesn't know how far it can push quantitative tightening before reserves are no longer sufficiently ample to hold short-term rates in check. All of this brings us to today's quantitative quantitative tightening program and when it might end. In an interview in January, Federal Reserve Governor Christopher Waller, referencing the 2019 episode, suggested that reserves at a level of 10 to 11% of nominal GDP might be appropriate. While Governor Waller will be the first to admit that this is a very rough estimate, in the absence of any better guess, the Fed may well use this as a yardstick for when to end quantitative easing. This is particularly the case because Chairman Powell has made it clear that the Fed wants to end QT before reaching a threshold at which they might again see spikes in short-term rates. As of today, nominal GDP is approximately $28 trillion, so 11% would be roughly $3.1 trillion. Total reserves plus reverse repo agreements are at $4.2 trillion. If the Fed continued its QT program as it is for another year, it could reduce reserves plus reverse repos by over $1.1 trillion, while nominal GDP could be expected to rise by roughly 5%, taking reserves below 11% of GDP, even if reverse repo balances fell close to zero. Consequently, it looks like the Fed will begin to taper QT this year, and hints that effect could be a positive for Treasury markets, allowing yields to drift sideways or down, even if the Fed continues to indicate only a very slow easing in short-term rates. For investors, this isn't exactly a rallying cry to buy bonds. However, it does suggest that the potential for a relatively stable financial environment exists, allowing equities to continue to move higher and fixed income to play its traditional role of providing income and diversification to portfolios.
Well, that's it for this week. Please tune in again next week. And if you have any questions in the meantime, please reach out to your JP Morgan representative.
This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.